You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, on the Friday News Roundup, the investigation into the January 6th attack casts a wider net, inflation hits a new high, and attention turns to two key homicide trials. That and more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, President Joe Biden was at the historic port of Baltimore this week selling the freshly passed infrastructure legislation he's about to sign. He painted a picture of what his administration is seeing in the current economy, setting the stage for the impact of the bill.
And on the good side, we're seeing the highest growth rate in decades, the fastest decrease in unemployment at this point ever since 1950. Jobs are up, wages are up, values are up, and savings are up. But we got problems, too. Many people remain unsettled about the economy, and we all know why. They see higher prices. They go to the store online, and they can't find what they always want and when they want it.
We're going to talk now about where we are economically, including the impact of inflation, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How's your economy looking right now in your household? Are you seeing inflation, higher prices on key things where you're at? Are you one of the many people who left a job last month? A huge number of people left a job last month. Was it for something better? Maybe better paying? Call in at 800-642-1234. And when you look at the economy, what indicator do you look at? Unemployment, inflation, stock market? 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Thomas Kemp is with us, professor and department chair in the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here, Rob.
Let's start with inflation. We got this number from the Labor Department this week. Increase in consumer price index of 6.2% in October compared to the previous year. Big number. How clear an indicator of inflation is that?
Yeah, it's getting to be significant. That's some of the highest inflation we've seen in 20 plus years. So while modest compared to the 1970s, it's not something that we're used to here in the States. And so it's setting people on edge a bit for sure.
We've heard from some economic officials, I think of the Federal Reserve, who have used the word transitory to apply to inflation. That can mean a lot of things. Transitory means something could go away tomorrow, or it could mean in a year, but it's not necessarily a long-term fundamental condition. What do economists mean when they say something like this is transitory?
Well, it's a bit of a hedge, isn't it, as you say? I mean, the short of it is that most economists do not believe that this inflation is sort of baked into the economy, if you will. And by that, would mean that it's getting contracted. So, for example, if you started seeing cost of living adjustments back in labor arrangements, where every year the employee automatically got a raise of 5 or 6 or 7%, or if you know firms were building those kind of increases into their purchasing orders or sales agreements, then of course inflation becomes self-fulfilling because it's effectively contracted, as was the case in the 1970s. That isn't the case at this point. So we expect the things that are causing inflation at this juncture to eventually not be there anymore.
What are those things causing inflation?
Yeah, that's a good question. And economists differ on that. It does seem from my reading the data that most of what's driving inflation at this point is business costs, and most particularly their labor costs. As President Biden mentioned a moment ago, wages are going up, but of course that contributes to business costs, and some of those get passed through onto consumers, and so we're seeing some of that with inflation.
And let's talk about, I mentioned another big number, a lot of people quitting their jobs in September in a new report that just came out, the Great Resignation, some people have called it, some are calling it the Quitening. That's just me. I made that one up. But what is driving this? Now, it's not people losing their jobs. They're leaving their jobs for one reason or another. What do you see behind that?
Yeah, that's another tough one to know. So the labor market is a fascinating thing right now, at least for us economists, because GDP is up from where we were pre-COVID. So the economy is larger inflation adjusted. So in real terms, than it was ahead of COVID, but yet we're missing over 3 million workers from the economy. So we've got fewer people producing more things than we had ahead of COVID. And why people are choosing to exit the labor market or to not return there's probably a million reasons out there.
Right. Some of it is some people have pointed it as a good news story. People are confident enough to leave their jobs either because they've got a better job lined up already or they're confident that they're going to find that better job. So in one reading of it, it's tough for business owners who are seeing people quit, but maybe it's an optimistic sign.
Yeah. You know, when we look at the data, we look at job leavers and then we look at new hires. Mm-hmm. Those two numbers track pretty nicely. So what it looks like is going on here is we're getting a lot more labor churn. So people leaving one job and then picking up another job, which, you know, most economists agree that is a good thing because you have people leaving jobs that maybe they were ill-suited towards and moving to jobs that they're better suited towards, which of course makes us all better off. Because they're going to be more productive at those new jobs.
Talking to Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair at UW-Claire's Department of Economics, looking at lots of economic news out there, some of it pointing in different directions. When we ask, how's the economy doing? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about inflation? Are you noticing? Are you feeling the pinch of higher prices where you are? Have you participated in the quitting? Have you left a job? Why? Did you move on to another one? Did you decide to retire early, maybe, because you're worried about risks of COVID at your workplace? We've heard a lot of different stories, even just here on Central Time. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Tom, I've heard from economists since early in the pandemic who said, you know, to fix the economy, fix the pandemic. How much do you see the still not done pandemic weighing on different parts of the economy?
Yeah, I think it's weighing quite heavily. In fact, if we think about it broadly, I think it probably accounts for most of the issues that we have. You know, of course, we have the pandemic, which we all are well aware of the effects there. But then we have the psychological impacts of the pandemic too, which are almost certainly at this point, you know, well over a year into this, weighing heavily on a lot of people's thinking, both in terms of the jobs they're willing to do and what they're purchasing.
Now let's turn toward the stock market. Just by the raw numbers of the stock market, it's done pretty well this year. The Biden administration not really spiking footballs on that one, not celebrating that much. And I know people often point out the stock market is not the economy. How important is it to watch what the market is doing as one, I guess, indicator, one symptom of how the overall economy is doing?
Well, it's important, right? People pay close attention to it. A lot of people have retirement plans, other interests in maintaining the value of the stock market. And people are going to make current consumption decisions. You know, should I buy a new car? What are my stocks doing? So it matters. But that said, we should recognize that, you know, when the stock market goes up, it doesn't necessarily mean that the economy is doing good. It just means that certain aspects of the economy are doing good. And conversely, it can go down and the economy could be doing well, you know, on the whole. So it's not something we should ignore, but we want to be careful when we attribute its change in value to overall economic performance.
And another, of course, thing people watch for are the unemployment numbers. A lot better than, say, a year ago as we emerge from the worst times of the pandemic. I think not still to where we were pre-pandemic. What are you watching for in employment numbers?
Yeah, the unemployment numbers are way down, right? So we're back into the low fours at this point, which is quite good by historical standards. But boy, there's still a large number of folks that left the labor market when COVID hit and they haven't come back. So we've got a labor force participation rate now of 61.5%, just about. Now, to give you some idea, that's about where we were in the mid-1970s. So that's, you know, before the great boom of the late 70s and 80s and 90s, where you had a lot of husbands and wives both working. You know, we've been moving back to almost a time before that, where we're looking at, you know, a lot of households are sitting one adult in the labor force. And so that's a bit of a mystery what's going on there. And it's certainly driving a lot of what we see in terms of prices.
We're talking to UW-Eau Claire economics professor Thomas Kemp about inflation and other economic indicators. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If I asked you, how's the economy doing? What would you say? What do you point to measure that? How is it going for you? Have you left a job lately, as so many people did, including just in September and the latest numbers out? You worried about prices going up where you are? Are you in the supply chain somewhere? Are you seeing hiccups or even burps? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, hear from some of you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair at the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics, talking about rising inflation and other factors that make up the health of the national economy and how to make sense of them in this moment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your story of staying at a job, leaving a job, why you did either or both. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Sonia is with us in Mequon. Sonia, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Sonia?
So I thought it was an interesting topic that you guys brought up in regards to why people are leaving the workforce in such significant numbers. And so I wanted to share my perception on why this is, you know, happening at such concentrated levels. I feel like when COVID hit, whatever your life, whatever your quality of life was that you were experiencing at that juncture, it was extremely concentrated. So, you know, I'm a caregiver, I'm a student, I take care of the household, and I do this all on my own. I don't have any help. My mother has dementia, and I couldn't get anybody to come in and help me. And it made me realize at that time that this is really what I have to do as far as going back to school and becoming a nurse. So it made me really hold on tight to my dream. But I think people who didn't necessarily have a dream, they realized they're really what their quality of life was, what their daily grind was. Okay. And then when you factor that, it's so multifactorial, but when you factor that in addition to the aspect of, we didn't have the socialization of the outside world to dilute those experiences that we were having in our homes with our family members in that tight introspective bubble that we were in.
I gotcha, Sonia. Interesting point. And I've heard this from some callers on other conversations, Tom, that the pandemic gave people a real opportunity and impetus to rethink their lives, including their work lives. And that might be part of what's leading people to change and or leave careers. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Sonia makes a lot of sense. I spent a chunk of time at home too. And I tell you, it was nice spending time with my daughter, who was actually at home from school, and my wife, who was also working from home for a while. And it did really make me think about what we're all doing here, I guess, is one way of saying it. And that's what I hear Sonia saying on the call. And, that may be the case. We may be in the midst of a reevaluation of work-life balance in American culture. And that is going to be an interesting thing to watch, and I think an exciting thing for us all to live through and to think about, how we want to order our lives going forward from this.
Sonia, thanks for the call. We'll go to Tom now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'm trying to figure out the ramifications of the current inflation. It seems to me that a lot of the cause for inflation is the increase in wages for at the lower end of the economic spectrum. And so if more people at the lower end are getting living wages now, clearly, doctors and lawyers, they're not getting increases in the salaries in the same way. So if people are getting more of a living wage at the lower end, that would cause possibly less need for government help. So is this a good thing?
Tom, thanks for the call. Do we know are wage gains really happening to that extent at lower levels? Tom, do we have the data on that yet?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't have the data and that sort of level of specificity that I would know that, but what Tom the caller is saying is correct. Inflation is always redistributive, so it moves things around society, and so we don't want to jump right on the bandwagon of saying that, you know, everything is bad about this, and we don't want to say it's good either, right? Inflation is going to change things, and it may change some things for the better. It may mean that we reduce income inequality. It may mean that folks at the bottom end up with a better wage relative to the goods and services that they have to buy. It may mean better working conditions, but it's also going to mean uncertainty too. So, you know, we're going to be less certain about, you know, for example, saving for retirement, or in terms of business, knowing what their cost structure is going to be like down the line. So inflation changes things. Some things could be better and other things are worse.
Tom, thanks for that call. We'll go now to Kent in Milwaukee. Kent, hi.
Hi. What I'm calling about, there's this mystery about the Great Resignation, as it's been called. And my thought is something that's been going on in the background for 10 years now or more is the baby boomer retirement wave. You know, that wave of people who entered the workforce is getting up there now, and that's going to peak probably in the next, you know, 5-6 years or so. And I think the peak has already passed, but I think that'll be the tail end of it, 5 or 6 years. And nobody brings that up in terms of the tightening of the workforce, I believe that is a major factor. People, retirement accounts have built up, the stock market's at a high, and people have looked around and thought, you know, I can afford to retire now. Maybe I'm going to. So people who can retire early are, and we've got that wave of baby boomers retiring that's been going on for some time.
Kent, thanks a lot for the call. And pre-pandemic, Tom, I know we did segments on, you know, Industry X or Profession X is seeing shortages because the baby boomers, as Kent was mentioning, are retiring. Now, if you're in that older group, you're also more vulnerable to COVID. Do you see that speeding up the baby boomer retirement that Kent's talking about?
Well, I imagine that's so. But it should be noted that the drop off in the labor force participation rate had been occurring for some years, and that probably was largely due to the baby boomers. But this event, this COVID event, is a specific event. There is a very precipitous drop off in labor force participation that we see when COVID starts, and it bounces back somewhat this last year, but we're just not at the levels we were before. Whereas before, we had a kind of steady decline. People were kind of exiting the labor market, but with COVID, there's just like the floor dropped out of it. So there is something special going on here. It's not just demographics. There has to be a little bit more to it. And you know, it's an interesting thing because the two ideas are related because, you know, so as I mentioned, GDP is up, but we have fewer workers. So you've got fewer people building more stuff effectively than we had before COVID. And, you know, what you're also showing in the data is that those folks are working longer hours. So you have fewer people working longer hours, making up the growing economy. And, you know, I suspect that that's also contributing to some of the issues that Sonia was talking about in the earlier call about quality of life and people really asking questions about, you know, what we're all doing here.
Ken, thanks for that call. We're talking about the economy and different ways to measure it with Tom Kemp from the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics. Let's go back to your calls now. Rana is with us in Cameron. Rana, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. So I recently used my truck as collateral to get a small loan for my daughter to finish college. And I have a 2015 Chevy Silverado. And as she was looking up the value according to Kelley Blue Book, she told me my truck appreciated and my truck is actually worth several thousand dollars more now than when I purchased it in 2018. And I said to her, would you look that up again? Because that just doesn't seem right. Trucks don't make money. They depreciate. And that's when I thought, okay, this is real. This is really happening. And I guess that's just all I have is an observation and a comment on my part.
Super interesting observation, Rana. Now, I could see that maybe being partly an inflation story, Tom, but more specifically, I mean, we've talked on this show in the past about a shortage of cars, new and used, driving up prices that might be going on here.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I know I was lucky enough to buy a car just before COVID too, and I'm sure glad I did. Yeah, the funny thing about inflation, right, is if you're holding money, the value of the money goes down. But if you're holding real things like cars, in this case, the prices are going up, right? So the price of your asset is going up. So this is what I was talking about a little earlier, that inflation is redistributive. It moves things around. If you had bought a car before COVID and inflation, you know, now it's worth more. If you were holding cash over that period, it's now worth less. So total value has moved from the person holding the car or person holding cash to the person with the car. Similarly with housing, right? So housing prices are going up. So if you're sitting on housing, you know, you're okay. You're doing all right.
Rana, thanks for that call. In our last half a minute or so, Tom, what are you watching for next? What piece of information are you curious to see?
Yeah, I'm keeping a close eye on labor force participation. I'm looking to see whether we're going to get folks back to work, whether wages are going to stabilize. So wages have moved up. Are they going to keep moving up? Are they going to stabilize? That's what I'm going to be paying attention to, because that's what's really going to tell us whether these prices stabilize.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob. It's always a pleasure.
That's Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair at the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics. We talked to him today about the state of the economy and inflation, how to sort out different economic indicators. Thanks to everyone who called in to share your own thoughts and your stories. You can keep doing that. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, humankind has faced a lot of devastating diseases throughout history, and there may be some lessons we could still learn today. We'll talk to the author of the new book, The Plague Cycle. Plus, have you seen this in the news? We'll check out the discovery of a 1,000-year-old boat in a Wisconsin lake. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll talk to Patty Heenich of the public TV show Patty's Mexican Table. She's got a new cookbook coming out about the wide variety of Mexican food. She'll tell us about some of her favorite dishes and the stories behind them. First, Wisconsin's legislative maps for the next 10 years are sitting on Governor Evers' desk, figuratively, if not literally. The state Senate passed the Republican-drawn districts along party lines on Monday. The state assembly followed suit yesterday. That's as far as they're expected to go. Evers has said he would veto any GOP redistricting plan. He's gotten behind proposals from a panel he created called the People's Maps Commission. But lawmakers rejected those maps this week, with a number of Democrats joining the vote against them. Assuming Evers vetoes the Republican maps, then it's up to the courts to figure out how to set the boundaries for the state's 33 Senate, 99 Assembly, and 8 congressional districts. But which court? Republicans want the state Supreme Court to sort it out. Democrats want it dealt with in federal court. Either way, it has to be settled by April 15th of next year at the latest. That's when candidates are scheduled to begin circulating nomination papers for fall primary elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you hope to see come out of all of this? If you had a chance to see the proposals, which ones do you think are more fair, the one that passed the legislature or the commissions? Or do you see flaws with both? Do you want redistricting to be done the way it's done now by lawmakers, or do you want a different method? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We're going to get a couple different perspectives. First, Joe Handrick is executive director of Common Sense Wisconsin, a former Republican state representative from Minocqua. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here.
You're looked at as a kind of a redistricting guru on the conservative side of things. You worked on this issue 10 years ago or so. First, what are your thoughts on what came out of the legislature this time around?
Well, the legislative map is what they are calling a least changes map, which means they took the map that was enacted 10 years ago and tried to make as little changes to it as possible. And that I presume that in doing that, what the legislature is doing is looking ahead to court when they have to present maps in court, because when a court draws a map, what a court is supposed to do and is expected to do is make the minimal changes to the existing law as necessary to bring the map back into conformance. And so I think the Republican legislature was simply looking ahead and trying to pass a map that they believe would be positively viewed by the courts.
Was that the method you and the people who worked on the maps 10 years ago used to set the maps that came to effect, I should say, in 2011?
Well, actually, it goes back further than that. A nonpartisan panel of federal judges in 1992 put in a new map for Wisconsin. And in the 2002 trial, which is now 20 years ago, the two sides had really the same arguments that you're hearing today. The Republicans in 2002 went to the court and said that what the court should do is base the new map off of the existing map. And Democrats back in 2002 told the court that the existing map, even though it was drawn by a federal panel of judges, that that map was too biased in terms of Republicans just because of the geography of Wisconsin. And they urged the court to throw out the existing map and start from scratch. So if that sounds familiar, that is from 2002. That's a little bit of a preview of what I think the argument will be when this heads to court this year or next year.
Now, your organization drew up a map, and as I understand it, you used not the 2011 map, our existing map, as the starting point. You went back to that 2002 map, if I'm reading it right. Could you tell us what kind of map you were looking for?
Yeah, well, we did both. We drew maps based off of the existing map, but we also went back 10 years and drew a map off of that court plan from 2002. And the reason we did that was the People's Maps Commission made it clear that they did not want to use the existing map that we have today as a starting point. But it's important to use something as a starting point, or you end up with a real disaster, which is actually what happened to the commission. So what we suggested to them was, fine, if you don't want to use the existing map as a starting point, if you believe that it's too partisan towards Republicans, then go back 10 years and use the map that was adopted by the court in 2002. They chose not to pay any attention to us, and what they did instead was they created a map from scratch, not based off of any prior map, and the results speak for themselves with the very large bipartisan vote against Governor Evers' maps.
One of the common criticisms of the existing map that the new maps that passed the legislature are based on, I think I could sum this up. We've had very close statewide elections in Wisconsin. Trump's win in 2016, Biden's in 2020, state constitutional offices in 2018, all really close races. But then we get an assembly, for example, that has a big Republican majority, even though these other elections are 50-50. What do you say to people who say that's evidence that the maps are biased too far on the behalf of Republicans?
Well, what it's evidence of is that in Wisconsin, Democratic voters are extremely concentrated in Madison, Milwaukee, and in a half dozen other cities. And so Wisconsin is a purple 50-50 state. But in Milwaukee and Madison, you have areas that are 80% and 90% Democratic. And so those districts are going to be 80% Democratic. And what happens when you create a bunch of districts in the two largest cities that are that overwhelmingly Democratic, that leaves the rest of the population of the state, means the rest of the state is going to lean towards the Republican side. So if you apply objective redistricting criteria and you simply draw a map and you don't pay any attention to politics, you start in one corner or any corner you wish, and you draw square, compact, equally populated districts, there's always going to be more Republican districts than there are Democratic districts. That's just the political makeup, the geopolitical makeup of the state of Wisconsin.
Talking to Joe Hendrick with Common Sense Wisconsin, looking at redistricting in the state. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Richland Center. Tom, hi.
Yeah, listen, I ran for assembly a couple of times in Richland County. And what the gentleman just said isn't exactly true. Richland County is very rural, and it went for Obama, and it went for Trump. So it's got the same issues that the state has. It flips back and forth. But generally speaking, the 68% of the seats are held by 38% of the votes or something like that. In terms of the Democrats have a chance only of getting 38% of the seats with all their votes, the way it is right now. So it's got to be more equitable. I support Iowa-style nonpartisan redistricting commission that uses logic and good geometry and not gerrymandering.
Tom, thanks for the call. And I've seen, to that first point, Joe, I've seen arguments that, yes, what you said about geography does give Republicans an advantage, but not that much of an advantage as we see in the current maps. What do you say to that and our caller's point?
Well, the gentleman raised actually the second reason that the Republicans have the size of majority they do now. You are correct. It's not entirely due to political geography. It's also partly due to the fact that in all of the very competitive races in the state of Wisconsin, Republicans have won most of them in the last 10 years. They've just simply done a better job of recruiting candidates and winning elections. There have been, in fact, 80 elections held in what we call 50-50 districts that are toss-up districts, and Republicans have won 69 out of those 80 seats. And that gentleman's part of the state is a great example of that. Grant County actually is a 50-50 county. It votes for Obama, but then it votes for Trump. It voted for Walker, you know, and then it voted for Tammy Baldwin. But yet a Republican at the assembly level has consistently won the Grant County Assembly District, not because of gerrymandering, but because that Republican candidate has always outperformed the rest of the ticket. The best example is right next to that gentleman in the 51st Assembly District, which is Iowa and Lafayette counties. Tony Evers got 55% of the vote in 2018 in that district, but yet that very same day, the Republican candidate for state assembly won. So the Democrats' problem in the legislature isn't just the maps. It's also their inability to win competitive districts and close districts.
And I want to wrap up with you, Joe, with our caller's second point. A lot of supporters of change point toward the Iowa model, a nonpartisan, or people call it a nonpartisan system. What do you think of the idea of doing that as opposed to sticking with our current system, lawmakers pass a thing and a governor signs it or sends it to the courts?
Right. Well, when it comes to nonpartisan commissions, one thing we know for sure now is that the model Tony Evers tried is an absolute disaster. But as for the Iowa model, what's important to note is that in Iowa, the legislature still passes the map. They do not have to accept what the commission sends them. So when the commission is drawing the districts, and right now in Iowa, for example, there's Republican control in the legislature. The commission knows that they better present a map that those Republican legislators are going to view favorably or it's not going to pass. And then I would note the exact opposite happens in California, where there's a nonpartisan commission. There's an overwhelming Democratic majority in the legislature. So their nonpartisan commission tends to forward maps that are advantageous to the Democrats. So I've never been convinced that it actually solves anything. And the biggest problem that I have with nonpartisan commissions is, well, who appoints the members of them? Because someone's still going to be appointing these members. And what we learned with Tony Evers' nonpartisan commission is that they were anything but nonpartisan. They actually, most of them turned out to be activists from the Democratic Party or liberal causes.
Thanks for the call. And Joe, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, and give my best to Jay Heck.
Joe Hendrick is Executive Director of Common Sense Wisconsin and a former Republican state representative from Minocqua. We talked to him about legislative maps that passed the legislature this week. Governor Evers expected to veto them, sending it to the courts to hash out. He set up the transition there. We'll hear from a critic of those Republican maps, Jay Heck, coming up. And you can still join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions on the topic of redistricting, the maps that are coming out from Republicans now, the ones we've had for the last 10 years, and the process we use to set those maps in the state. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the latest developments on Wisconsin's legislative maps. Earlier this week, the state Senate rejected proposals from Governor Evers' People's Maps Commission and approved the boundaries drawn by Republicans. The assembly followed suit yesterday, sending the GOP maps to Evers. He is expected to veto their plan. That means the courts are going to end up deciding what the maps will look like, most likely. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on where we are now, what you hope comes out of all this. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Joe Hendrick in our last segment about his organization's ideas on how to draw the state's legislative borders. Now Jay Heck joins us, Executive Director of Common Cause in Wisconsin. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Great to talk to you again. It's been a long time.
It's been a while. Yeah. What are you hoping happens here once these maps land on Governor Evers' desk?
Well, that he vetoes them really before they even hit the desk. You know, these are the most gerrymandered maps 10 years ago when the Republicans really were the architects of the most gerrymandered partisan maps in the entire nation, and amongst the worst in the last 50 years. And the maps that they put forward this week and passed along strict party lines are simply a reflection of the same thing they did 10 years ago. What my friend Joe Hendrick kind of glossed over was the fact that in 2011, Republicans moved 2.4 million Wisconsinites in order to redraw congressional and state legislative districts so that they would be able to control them for 10 years. And this time around, they've said, well, we want to retain the districts just as they were 10 years ago, because we don't want to confuse the poor people of Wisconsin. We want core retention. And so the hypocrisy is just incredible. So what they want to do is bake in the most partisan gerrymandered maps in the last in Wisconsin's history.
Now, we heard the argument there that Wisconsin, the geography, the population kind of gerrymanders itself, with Democrats concentrated in some areas. To translate those numbers into more seats, you'd have to do some convoluted cartography. That's part of the story here, right?
Well, it is true that Democrats tend to concentrate a bit more in urban areas. But, you know, gerrymandering wasn't a thing before 2011. And that's why control of the Wisconsin legislature flipped back and forth between Republicans and Democrats. And so while there is some truth to the fact that Republicans are more spread out, you can certainly draw a map that doesn't pack Democrats into many fewer districts, which is what the Republicans did in 2011 and want to do again this time, and spread out Republicans just enough so that you can win any seat that is possibly close. The fact is, there are so few close seats. We have 99 assembly districts in Wisconsin, less than 10%, less than 9 of them are even remotely competitive. And that is a function of rigging the maps to get a preordained outcome. And that's what they're trying to do again.
Now, you've been supportive of the process of the People's Maps Commission giving this alternative map. What did you think of their final product?
Well, you know, look, the People's Maps Commission is a brand new thing. They were citizens. They were amateurs. They didn't have experts like Joe Hendrick writing their maps. And I think the process was great because it was open. There was 10 months of hearings where the public could weigh in. Over 1,000 maps were submitted to the People's Maps consideration for consideration. Very unlike the Republican process, which was done again in secret with almost no public input. The final product, I think, was flawed. There's no question. I urged, and Common Cause urged them not to have fewer majority districts. That's one of the things that came out of the final version. And that is why there was such a bipartisan vote against the People's Maps in the Wisconsin legislature. But, you know, it's not the People's Maps that are on trial. It's the Republican maps. Everyone knew that this was going to be the maps that are going to pass. And those are the maps that will be considered by the courts, not the People's Maps, although the People's Maps might be considered by the court as possible alternatives.
We are talking to Jay Heck from Common Cause Wisconsin about redistricting here in the state. The maps just passed by Republicans, expected to be vetoed by Governor Evers. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jimmy in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I live in central Wisconsin. I've been redistricted in the last 30 years 3 times. I had Tom Petrie and Ron Kind, and then I didn't know it, but I had Sean Duffy from way up in northern part of Wisconsin. And I think one of the aspects of redistricting is there's supposed to be a community of interest, you know, amongst the folks in that district. And I don't know what we got in common down here in central Wisconsin with somebody who lives in Bayfield like Tom Tiffany.
Thanks for that call. And Jay, some people find the borders shifting beneath their feet.
Yeah, it's remarkable. As I mentioned, in 2011, they moved 2.4 million people. That's a third of the state, more than a third of the state, just like this gentleman, so that they could get partisan control. And that's not as it should be. You know, the solution to this, and you touched on it with Joe Hendrick, is to have a nonpartisan system like they have in Iowa. And in Iowa, it's the legislative, the equivalent of the Legislative Reference Bureau that draws the maps, but they draw them according to strict nonpartisan criteria. Things like squares and rectangles are good, you know, keeping counties together. The Republican gerrymander split 48 counties, and we only have 72 in Wisconsin in 2011. So there's a better way to do it. And the nonpartisan system in Wisconsin, or in Iowa, was put into place by a Republican governor, a Republican legislature, and just last week, a Republican trifecta, legislature and governor, passed the nonpartisan maps drawn by the Reference Bureau. It's something that could be done in Wisconsin. But unfortunately, Robin Voss and Devin Lemieux, the leaders, do not want to give up the tremendous power that they have over their members by being able to control the redistricting process.
Let's go back to our callers now. Daniel is on the line in Campbellsport. Daniel, hi.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Daniel?
Well, in my case, in 20th District is in Campbellsport area, in Ozaukee County and in Fond du Lac, Sheboygan counties, is they didn't have any candidates at the last election, even though everybody knew that it was probably going to swing heavily Democratic. The Democratic Party didn't any up a single candidate, and Dewey Strobel won that district unopposed, even though he had to primary himself. So even though I'm a lifelong Democrat, I tend to agree with the previous host or expert that you got to have a candidate to win. It doesn't matter what the districts are drawn, but they use that as an excuse not to even run a candidate.
Daniel, thanks for the call. Jay, the argument that Democrats are blaming gerrymandering for their failures in fielding candidates in the legislature.
Well, if Daniel's senator was Dewey Strobel, he was in a utterly safe Republican district, and there's no chance that a Democrat would have won. And it is true that there are some districts in Wisconsin where one party or the other do not put up a candidate because it's hopeless, because the election has already been decided by the way the lines were drawn. And Campbellsport is in a district that is safe Republican. There's not a chance a Democrat would win that district in the way that it has been drawn right now. And that's exactly the problem. What we should do is be able to draw districts where there is more competition and where there's more ability for candidates of both political parties to be able to state their case to the voters, rather than just have the winner of the Republican primary or the Democratic primary be declared the winner in the general election.
Thanks for that call. And Jay, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Jay Heck, Executive Director of Common Cause in Wisconsin. We talked to him about the status of Wisconsin's legislative maps. Governor Evers is expected to veto the Republican-led plans, sending the matter to the courts to decide, state courts or federal courts. We'll see. Earlier, we heard another perspective from Joe Hendrick from the group Common Sense Wisconsin. By the way, if you want to learn more about redistricting in Wisconsin and how we got where we are today, check out WPR's recent podcast series called Mapped Out. You can listen to all 6 episodes. A lot of great information in there at WPR.org/mappedout. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We'll talk to Patty Heenich, host of the public TV show Patty's Mexican Table, about her new book and some of her favorite Mexican dishes and the big variety of foods that come out of Mexico. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.